When that, 3 a.m. existential dread hits, I mean, most of us try to fix it by reaching for a meditation app, right? Or we just endlessly doom scroll until our eyes give out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's like a modern reflex at this point.
Right. But what if, like, the ultimate survival guide for that specific brand of modern anxiety was actually written over 2,000 years ago? And get this, it's a massive 7,000-line poem about, well, quantum physics.
I mean, it sounds like a total contradiction in terms. We don't usually look to ancient poetry for hard science, you know, let alone a cure for the feeling that we are just these tiny, helpless specks in a chaotic universe.
Yeah, but that's exactly what we're looking at today in this deep dive. The source material we're pulling apart is a text called De Rerum Natura, which translates to On the Nature of Things.
Which is such a massive sweeping title, honestly.
It really is. It's a first century BC didactic poem by the Roman poet and philosopher Lucretius, and it's written entirely in dactylic hexameter, which is the same grand rhythm Homer used for the Iliad.
Right, but instead of mythical heroes and gods, Lucretius is writing this epic about atoms. He's writing about the void and just the raw mechanics of reality.
Which is wild. So our mission today is to uncover how this ancient Roman used atomic theory to essentially, like, hack human anxiety.
Yeah, and we'll explore how his ideas were nearly completely erased by history, too. They only survived by a miracle to basically lay the groundwork for the modern scientific worldview.
Exactly. So if you have ever felt paralyzed by the sheer randomness of the world, Lucretius was literally speaking directly to you. But to cure that paralysis, he was selling a philosophy that was a notoriously tough pill to swallow for a Roman audience.
Oh, for sure. He was a devout follower of Epicureanism. And today, I mean, we hear the word Epicurean and we think of, like, someone curating a fancy charcuterie board. Right?
Yeah, like drinking really expensive wine and just lounging around.
Exactly. But the original Greek philosopher, Epicurus, he was dealing with something much, much deeper. He diagnosed the root of human misery and he boiled it down to two massive systemic fears.
Okay, let's unpack this. What were those two fears?
Well, the first was the dread of unpredictable, angry gods. Gods who micromanage the world and might, you know, strike you down with lightning if you forgot a sacrifice.
Right. The classic lightning bolt from above anxiety.
Yeah. And the second was the sheer paralyzing terror of eternal torture in the afterlife.
I mean, that is just the ultimate anxiety cocktail right there. So to cure it, Epicurus basically went straight to the root of the issue.
He did. He argued that the universe wasn't managed by divine beings at all. He invoked the much older ideas of Democritus and claimed the entire material universe was just the result of elemental particles.
Just atoms falling through an infinite void.
Exactly. No gods pulling the strings anywhere. Just simple, purposeless, natural laws.
Which logically, you know, solves the anxiety problem. If lightning is just a shift in atmospheric pressure and not Jupiter throwing a massive tantrum, you don't have to live in fear of Jupiter.
Right. It takes the personal vendetta out of nature.
But stripping away the traditional gods in the afterlife, I mean, that completely undermined the bedrock of Roman society. So Lucretius realized that raw, atheological physics wouldn't really capture the Roman imagination on its own.
No, not at all. He had a massive marketing problem on his hands.
He really did. And the sources use this great analogy for it. If you need to give a dog a bitter medicine, you don't just toss it the pill, right? You hide it inside a piece of cheese.
Oh, yeah, the classic trick.
Yeah, and Lucretius uses a nearly identical metaphor right in the poem itself. He compares his poetry to smearing sweet honey on the rim of a cup to trick a sick child into drinking a bitter, life-saving medicine.
It's such a striking image.
Right. The idea that you are just atoms and that you will one day completely cease to exist, that is the bitter wormwood. The sweeping, gorgeous, epic poetry, that's the honey.
And what's fascinating here is the historical irony, because Epicurus himself explicitly instructed his followers to avoid writing poetry altogether.
Wait, really? The founder of the school hated poetry.
Yeah, he believed that the literal truth of the universe didn't need any decoration. He thought poetic flourishes only muddied the waters of clear, logical thought.
Oh, wow. Lucretius clearly disagreed with the boss on that one.
He absolutely did. He knew his Roman audience needed the spectacle. But that honey, you know, it creates a glaring, almost hilarious contradiction right in the opening lines of the poem.
Oh, right. The invocation to Venus.
Yes. Lucretius opens this epic masterwork, a text dedicated to proving that the gods absolutely do not care about human affairs by passionately praying to a god.
He addresses Venus, the goddess of love, urging her to pacify her lover Mars and bring peace to Rome.
It seems totally hypocritical on the surface. He's saying the gods don't intervene, but please, Venus, intervene for us.
So how do scholars make sense of that? Because it feels like a massive oversight for such a logical guy.
Well, they've debated it for centuries, honestly, but the consensus is that Lucretius is using Venus as a poetic metonym. He's not visualizing a literal, you know, physical woman sitting on Mount Olympus.
Ah, okay, so it's more symbolic.
Exactly. By addressing her as Alma Venus, the nurturing mother, she really represents the creative, reproductive drive of the cosmos itself.
Oh, I see.
Scholars like Diskin Clay point out that she embodies the drive of nature, the physical act of creation. The poetry is just doing its job, right? Easing the reader into a godless universe by using the comforting, familiar language of Roman mythology.
That makes so much sense. I mean, we all use our own version of honey to sugarcoat the difficult truths we have to swallow in life.
Oh, definitely.
And if we, as the listener, accept Lucretius's bitter medicine that everything is just atoms and void, the immediate terrifying question for his Roman audience becomes, well, what happens to my soul when I die?
Which is the big one. He had to tackle this head on if he actually wanted to cure their anxiety.
Right. Because to dismantle the fear of eternal punishment, Lucretius had to prove that the mind and the spirit, which he calls the mens and the anima, are entirely material.
Yes, they aren't some mystical floating energy. To him, they are physical objects.
And he gets incredibly specific about the mechanics of this, which I just find fascinating. He doesn't just say, oh, the soul is physical. He deduces what kind of atoms actually make up human consciousness.
Yeah, his reasoning here is so clever.
It is. Because human thought is instantaneous, right? You can picture a horse or a mountain in a fraction of a second. Hmm. So he argues that the atoms of the mind must be exceptionally small, incredibly fine, and perfectly smooth.
So they can move around with basically zero friction.
Exactly. But that physical deduction is crucial, isn't it?
Oh, it's everything. Because if the mind is made of physical atoms, then it is subject to the exact same natural laws as a rock or a tree. It is entirely mortal.
So when the body breaks down?
When the structure of the body fails, those tiny, smooth atoms simply disperse back into the void. The soul literally dies with the body.
He uses this really vivid visual of a vessel for this. He says the physical body is just a clay jar holding the water of the mind and spirit. And when the jar shatters, the water just spills out and dissipates into the dry earth.
It's a beautiful metaphor, but yeah, it has heavy implications.
Let's pause and look at this from the perspective of his target audience, though. Lucretius dedicated this poem to a Roman judicial official named Gaius Memmius.
Right, a high-stress political guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you are trying to comfort a stressed-out politician, telling him he's just going to shatter and evaporate into absolute nothingness, I mean, that sounds incredibly bleak.
To a modern ear, especially one heavily influenced by centuries of focus on immortal souls, it absolutely sounds bleak. But Lucretius frames it as the ultimate liberation.
Really? How so?
Well, a dead person cannot miss being alive. You cannot suffer if you literally do not exist to experience the suffering. And to lock this concept in, he introduces what modern philosophers now call the symmetry argument.
Okay, let me see if I can trace his logic here. If I look back at the centuries before I was born, like the Punic Wars, the building of the pyramids, the rise and fall of entire civilizations, I obviously wasn't suffering during any of that. It was just a blank.
Right, you didn't feel a thing.
So is his argument simply a mirror of that exact experience?
That is the exact mechanism of the argument, yeah. He asks the reader to recognize that the infinite, endless ages of time before their birth felt like a deep, dreamless, peaceful sleep.
Okay, I'm with you.
Therefore, logically, the infinite nothingness that comes after your death must be entirely symmetrical. You cannot bewail your own non-existence because there is no you left to experience the regret.
Wow. So the fear of death is exposed as just a complete logical fallacy.
Exactly. He flips it entirely.
You know, that reframing actually is strangely comforting, the mere image of time. But this whole materialist worldview creates another massive philosophical roadblock.
Oh, a huge one.
Let's make this personal for a second. If the universe is entirely made of atoms falling through a void, governed by unbending natural laws, then every single action is just the result of a previous physical collision, right?
That's the logical conclusion of basic atomism, yes.
That means me deciding to read the source material, or you, the listener, tuning into this deep dive right now, all of it was pre-programmed at the dawn of time. We are essentially just biological robots.
And that right there is the central, inescapable crisis of atomism, determinism. Mm.
Yeah.
If every movement is just the mechanical result of a previous movement, we're stretching back into infinity, then our choices aren't choices at all.
Which ruins the whole philosophy, doesn't it?
It's a complete disaster for Epicureanism. If humans have no free will, then ethics and morality are totally meaningless. You can't advise someone to live a tranquil, virtuous life if they literally have zero control over their own actions.
So how does he get out of it? Because if you picture his universe initially, he describes atoms falling straight down through the infinite void by their own weight.
Like rain.
Yeah, let's imagine dropping a handful of marbles straight down in a complete vacuum. They fall perfectly in parallel. They never collide. So if the universe is just atoms falling in straight lines forever, how do you ever get the very first collision that builds a planet or a star or, you know, a human brain?
Right.
Making a spontaneous choice.
Here's where Lucretius introduces one of the most famous and honestly historically debated concepts in the entire poem. He calls it the clinamen.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The swerve, right?
The swerve, yes. Lucretius postulates that as these microscopic atoms fall straight down, occasionally at entirely unpredictable times and in completely uncertain places, they deflect just a tiny microscopic fraction of a degree.
They just swerve.
For no reason.
For no reason at all. They just swerve.
It's like a random glitch in a video game's code. You know, you have thousands of characters moving exactly on their programmed deterministic paths. But then a single line of code randomly glitches a swerve and one character bumps into another, cascading into a completely new, unscripted scenario. That is a perfect analogy. That single microscopic glitch provides the foundation for Fortuna, which is chance.
All right.
The swerve causes one atom to bump into another, creating this massive chain reaction that clumps matter together to form the entire universe.
And it solves the free will problem too.
Exactly. This raises an important question though, right? Because Lucretius argues this unpredictability is the actual physical root of libera voluntas, free will. The mind isn't strictly bound by cause and effect because the atoms composing it occasionally swerve on their own.
So we are talking about a poet in the first century BC, essentially predicting the concept of quantum indeterminacy.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, thousands of years before Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, Lucretius recognized that for the universe to be creative and for humans to have any agency, there must be an element of fundamental unpredictability baked into the fabric of reality.
It is a stunning intellectual leap, truly. But, you know, we shouldn't pretend Lucretius had a perfect map of the cosmos.
Oh, definitely not.
While his instincts on atoms and chance were incredibly prescient, his actual hard science frequently hit a brick wall.
Yeah, he got some things hilariously wrong. I mean, despite advocating so fiercely for natural observation, Lucretius concluded in his first book that the Earth was flat.
Which is funny, considering the Greeks already knew it wasn't.
Right. He actively mocked the idea of a spherical Earth, just completely ignoring the fact that Greek astronomers had already established it as a really well-supported theory by his time.
And his explanations of astronomy are even more revealing. When Lucretius tries to explain how the stars and the sun move across the sky, he doesn't even commit to a single theory.
He just gives a list of options, right?
Yeah, he literally gives his readers a multiple choice test. He suggests that, well, perhaps the whole sky rotates like a giant wheel, or maybe the sky sits perfectly still and there are invisible currents of air pushing the stars along.
And didn't he say something about the stars looking for food?
Yes. He even floats the idea that the stars are basically swimming around on their own looking for fiery food in the pastures of the sky.
He essentially throws his hands up and says, you know, one of these has to be right, but we honestly have no way of knowing which.
Exactly. And historian William Stahl makes a really brilliant point in the sources about this. Lucretius wasn't trying to map the cosmos perfectly. That wasn't the goal.
What was the goal then?
His naturalistic explanations were solely meant to bolster the ethics of Epicureanism. He relegated all these distant astronomical phenomena to the class of unclear objects.
So the details didn't matter to him.
Right. To him, the specific physical mechanism didn't matter as long as the reader accepted it was a natural process. and not, you know, Apollo dragging the sun across the sky in a chariot.
Got it. As long as divine intervention is completely out of the picture, the anxiety is cured.
Exactly.
But, I mean, telling people, hey, God didn't make the world, the gods don't care about you, and your soul is going to evaporate, that was a catastrophic PR move once history moved forward, especially once Christianity became the dominant force in Europe.
Oh, the clash was completely inevitable. Historian Ada Palmer notes that denying providence, denying miracles, the efficacy of prayer, and an immortal soul that earned Lucretius the label of being proto-atheistic.
Even though he didn't technically deny the gods existed, right?
Technically, no. Epicureans claim the gods lived far away in the spaces between worlds and were just totally indifferent to human affairs.
But to the early Christian church, an indifferent god is functionally the exact same as no god at all.
Precisely. If there's no divine providence guiding history and no immortal soul to save, the entire moral framework of Christianity is completely undermined.
You can totally see why early theologians wanted to bury this text.
And they really, really tried. Their early church fathers reacted with just pure vitriol. Lactantius, who was a prominent Christian apologist, heavily critiqued the poem. He called Lucretius the most worthless of the poets.
Ouch.
Yeah, he claimed he couldn't even read the lines without laughing at the sheer absurdity of the atomic swerve. He sarcastically asked who would ever think Lucretius had a functioning brain.
So they just tried to erase it entirely.
Because it was viewed as this dangerous atheist manifesto, the poem was widely disparaged, neglected, and just actively suppressed for centuries.
So for hundreds of years during the Middle Ages, the text essentially vanished from the broader intellectual record, which begs the question, if the institutional power of the church hated it that much, how do we even have all these sources sitting in front of us today?
It survived by the absolute thinnest of margins. A few isolated copies were preserved in 9th century monastic scriptoriums.
Wait, copied by monks?
Yes. Copied by the very monks whose theology the poem was actively trying to dismantle. Today, the two oldest surviving manuscripts, the Codex Oblongus and the Codex Quadratus, are actually housed in Leiden.
That is incredible irony. But the moment that actually changes the trajectory of Western thought happens later, right? In January 1417.
Yes, exactly.
A man named Poggio Bracciolini, who is this Italian humanist and professional book hunter, is digging through a really remote Benedictine library in Germany, likely at Fulda. And he pulls this dusty manuscript off a shelf, and it's De Rerum Natura.
Poggio's discovery is arguably one of the most consequential intellectual events in all of human history.
So what does this all mean? I mean, imagine being a 15th century thinker, completely steeped in a culture of divine micromanagement.
Right, where everything has a religious cause.
Yeah. Every famine, every plague, every political victory is attributed directly to the will of God. And then suddenly you open this ancient book and read a stunningly eloquent argument that the universe just runs itself. It must have been a total paradigm shift.
It was an absolute earthquake. The ideas leaked out and essentially infected the entire Renaissance. The legacy of that single manuscript is just staggering.
Who was reading it?
Well, Machiavelli hand-copied the poem early in his life.
Really? Machiavelli?
Yes. For someone developing a political theory based on human cunning and power against the unpredictability of fortune, Lucretius's godless, swerving universe was highly, highly relevant.
That makes total sense.
And Michel de Montaigne, the great essayist, he owned a heavily annotated copy. He quoted Lucretius nearly 100 times in his explorations of human nature.
Wow. And the ripple effect goes all the way to the founding of the United States, too.
Oh, absolutely. Thomas Jefferson, who famously pursued the Epicurean ideal of happiness, owned at least 5 different copies of the poem in multiple languages.
It's just wild to think about. It literally laid the philosophical groundwork for the modern scientific revolution. It even inspired Stephen Greenblatt's Pulitzer-winning book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern.
So in a way, Lucretius actually accomplished his goal. He built a framework for understanding nature and curing superstitious fear. He was just, you know, about 1,500 years late.
He was playing a generational long game.
He really was. It's a testament to the fact that ideas, much like Lucretius's atoms, cannot be easily destroyed. They simply drop out of sight, rearrange themselves, and emerge centuries later in entirely new forms.
A Roman poet, writing in hexameter, trying to calm down his stressed-out friend with the bitter medicine of atomic theory, sweetened with the honey of poetry.
Yep.
And he survives the mockery of early theologians by hiding in their own monasteries, only to be dusted off and basically sparks the Renaissance.
It's the ultimate comeback story.
It really is. So, to you listening, the next time you find yourself staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m., feeling completely overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the world, remember the swerve. In a universe of falling atoms, there is always room for a glitch, for chance, and for you to make a choice.
Though, you know, if we are exploring the full reality of Lucretius's worldview, there is one final lingering detail from the sources that kind of complicates that comforting thought.
Oh, you mean the ending of the poem?
Yes. De Rerum Natura is a masterpiece designed entirely to cure the fear of death and find tranquility in the natural order. But the poem doesn't actually end on a note of peaceful atomic resolution.
Right. It cuts off abruptly.
It cuts off right at the end of book six, right in the middle of a horrific, visceral description of the plague of Athens. He describes the physical torment, the despair, the total breakdown of society in just agonizing detail.
And the scholarly consensus is that it ends there because Lucretius himself died unexpectedly before he could finish editing the work, right?
Exactly. The man who wrote the ultimate intellectual guide to conquering the fear of death was taken by his own sudden, unpredictable demise, leaving his magnum opus forever suspended in a scene of mass death and suffering.
Man, it's a profound paradox to mull over. If a masterpiece dedicated to finding peace and controlling your anxiety through logic is left unfinished because of a random historical plague, does that validate his entire argument about the chaotic, unpredictable swerve of the universe?
Right. Or does it highlight the ultimate limits of human control?
Yeah, proving that despite our best theories, we're all still just at the mercy of chance. Definitely something to think about next time you're staring at the ceiling.